I'm Tarfia Faizullah, and this is Jamal May, and we're going to be reading for y'all this afternoon. Jamal May is the author of Hum, which is forthcoming from Alice James Book in 2013, and the winner of this year's Beatrice Holly Prize. He is an incredible poet, one who I feel like my work has been changed by knowing him and by knowing his work, and I'm really honored to read with him today. So without any further ado, Jamal May.
Yo, what's up? So I'm not like, I don't have my poems sorted right now, so I'm gonna try something that's very interesting and moronic. I'm basically just gonna like, kind of have an organic ordering, I'm about to call it. I made that term up just now, which basically means I'm gonna read poems based on like, if I think about another poem, like, oh wait, I should read, you ever been like, you know, like, yo, that's right, that one poem. So whatever poems I get reminded of as I read, I'm just gonna try and like go through them. I'm gonna be reading from maybe a couple things from The Wedding, these chapels, The Wedding of Teeth and God Engine, and then from, and I might read something from the new book I'm working on called The Big Book of Exit Strategies. I'm starting with a poem that's in both Hum and this chapbook. It's called Athazagoraphobia. There are 6 fear poems in the manuscript, and this is one of them, Athazagoraphobia, which is the fear of being ignored. I used to bury plum pits between houses. Buried bits of wire there too. Used to bury matches, but nothing ever burned and nothing ever thrived. So I set fire to a mattress, disassembled a stereo, attacked flies with a water pistol, drowned ants in perfume. I pierced my eyebrow, inserted a stainless steel bar, traded that for a scar and a melee, pressed tongue to nipple in a well-lit parking lot, swerved into traffic while unbuttoning my shirt. There's a woman waiting for me to marry her. Or forget her name forever, whichever loosens the ribbons from her hair. I filled the bathtub for this enemy, licked the earlobe of my nemesis. I try to dance like firelight without setting anyone ablaze. I'm leaning over the railing of a bridge, seeing my face shimmer at the bottom. It's everywhere now. Look for me in the scattered windshield beneath an overpass, on a sculpture of a man with metal skin grafts. In patterns of mud-draggled wood, feathers circling leaves in rainwater. Look, even the blade of a knife holds my likeness while I run out of ways to say, I am here. This is a Detroit Hum ending with bones. Glass above my bed vibrates from the bass pouring out of 12-inch speakers, and I almost don't mind being jolted awake because I know this song. It's not a favorite song, but I know it, and sometimes that's plenty. Sometimes I need more rattle from the cabinet, a thrumming lawnmower out there, the sound of my twin sister snoring in the next room. Even better, the whir of a fan spinning in her lap as the click of keys becomes her new story, and when that is not enough, I may take off my shirt, press my back against a refrigerator, one of those beige monsters you can feel working for its hum. A hummingbird draws nectar in my thoughts, wings beating 80-something times per second, but that's nowhere near here. Been a few summers since I even stopped listening for bees. A study says that cell phones near hives confuse honeybee signals. They're natural technology, too outmoded for a message from my father vibrating in my pocket to not make a drone go haywire and spiral into the grass. Is that enough? Then what about your Chrysler that idles so hard it tickles you from thigh to earlobe? There is always a hymn waiting for ears, a Tibetan singing bowl looking for an audience, a vibraphone that begs to collide over and over with the yarn-tipped mallets you hold. And even when you were young and smirking and the clerk was definitely afraid of you, the tremble of his hand made your chains jingle, a small tune made of fear just for you. You remember it. I still remember elementary science. Mrs. Reese telling us to read the whole sentence before trying to fill its blanks. We learned to use as a placeholder for answers, as in hearing. The only sense that is completely mechanical begins when sound travels the vibrates your eardrum, and is amplified by the a group of tiny bones. I'm gonna read 2 of Sestinas that appear in the book. The framework of the book is, it has the second poem and the second to last poem of both Sestinas, where the 6 repeating words are from the 6 fears that appear in the book. Yeah, maybe you can pick them out. All right, so, and then I'll read some more phobias. See how this is working? This is going together, right? All right, so this is Hum of the Machine God. There isn't much to discuss with the machine god, though its voice is hard to ignore. It speaks in planks of wood shaped for the sea. It sputters of smoke, eats grass. It spits snow into piles, commands the motion of a needle through a hem. It hums. It waits. I spoke to it in a parking lot, waiting for an exchange between my mother and a sewing machine to come to an end. Her needle-skilled fingers, callous, had learned to ignore pain. I was still working on it. The snow under Dad's idling car became a sea, running into drains towards another sea that I hope is out there waiting. Almost heard it one morning, shoveling snow as a neighbor's garage rattled with machinery, bolt building tools, and with a thrum I was told to ignore. A goddamn fool. Might as well build a thing with needles, Dad said, but it held me, watching him needle a board through a notch. I saw a wooden sea dragon, dreamed of riding it away. Boy, don't ignore me. My lip split open. Shovel, he hated waiting. Had even less patience when repairing the machine, coughing in our yard with a snow-colored stone in its throat. Yes, I prayed the snowblower would take his hand. Yes, the needle of Mom's scream as his thumb was machined away, drowned out Dad's wailing. I listened for the sea. Gripped my shovel, my oar. Now in a waiting room, I bow to the fluorescent hum and beg. Ignore my prayer, my stupid little prayer. Please ignore my voice. They say the thumb, packed in snow, will be almost impossible to reattach. Waiting as if to plead, let me try. Give me the needle. Mom taps a knitting needle against the seafoam colored formica, rapid as a machine, but the machine god, busy with the lights, will ignore the needle's Morse code prayer. And with the mouth full of snow, I will hum and wait for his answer to swim from my sea. On metal. Drags at the back of a throat. Occasionally becomes when three men huddle around a car, admitting some smaller defeat, while not quite admitting the emergence of digital parts means this won't be solved by Ratchet alone. No one is happy to learn what an afternoon of chafed knuckles and metal on skin no longer solves, what cannot be pulled from the steel tangle under a hood. It's as though they found the wrench that could set free a bike from its training wheels, only to discover their daughters have had driver's licenses for years. I clapped the man at the center of this trio on his shoulder, not quite hard enough to shake loose a cigarette dangling almost acrobatically from his lips, and say, fuck it, man. I'll just take it to a dealership. I say this as if this is not a huddle, as if I'm not a team manager plucking the ball from my pitcher's tipped glove in an early inning of a game that falls near the wane of an otherwise solid career. These damn things are like robots now, he concedes, slams the hood, rattles the chassis, and he's probably right, considering the clank of metal closing on metal, but I still can't help thinking of how much this thing is like a body. The mystery of my Chrysler's right side not responding, silent speaker, headlamp dead, window sealed shut, frozen power door lock is no more mystifying than my left ear's frequency range, which is limited, or the left eye, I'm now told, is blind by a doctor who huddles over me to assess some unknown damage. Damage that is ongoing. A diminishment I live with. I don't get cars, but I get this. The difficult science of getting a wreck off cinder blocks, while my dad once fiddled daily with a dead Camaro, refusing to believe its silence. How to disappear completely. You are quarter ghost on your mother's side. Your heart is a flayed peach in a bone box. Your hair comes away in clumps like cheap fabric wet. A reflecting pool gathers around your altar of plywood subflooring and split wooden slats. You are ragdoll prone. Here you are contort, angle, and arc. Here you are a greening abdomen, slipping skin, flesh fly, carrion beetle. This is where bullets found shelter, where size found their function, where breath lost its place on the page, where the page was torn out of every book before chapters closed. This is slippage. This is a shroud of neglect pulled over the body. This is your chance to escape. Little wraith, bend light around you until it colors you clear. Disappear like silica in a kiln. Become glass and glass beads. Become the staggered whir of an exhaust fan, a presence only noticed when gone. Become origami. Fold yourself, smaller than ever before. Become less, more in some ways, but less in the way a famine is less. We will all forgive you for not being satisfied with fitting in our hands. We will forgive you for dying to be a bird diminutive enough to fit inside of a mouth and not be crushed. The sky now black with birds. If I tell you, riot helmets outnumbered protesters who stuck around to punch the courtyard grass after Troy Davis's heart was stilled by the drip of potassium chloride. And I say, glare flickered off one cop's visor and startled a pine siskin from its tree. You might be able to see that, its notched tail and yellow streaks flailing. Or maybe you'd miss it if you were there near the forest of batons. Distracted by the woman sprawled face down in the lawn gripping a Bible as the green sea began to memorize the shape of her grief. If I say death, cure death, and have such power over the scythe, how many bodies will it take to lift her out of this drowning? If I tell you, white supremacist Lawrence Brewer was executed 5 hours earlier for the murder of James Byrd, if I ask you to look for birds foraging between his intricate tattoos, I don't mean to distract you from the cross that was burning on his arm that day. I don't expect you to stare into a graffiti of iron crosses and spider webs sprawled across a supremacist's flesh and find a thrush vibrating with birdsong. But I want you to know why I listen for more than the calling of crows. Not knowing if I've ever wanted a man more dead, I wonder how could forgive ever fit inside of my mouth, but it's always there, fluttering behind the tongue of Ross Byrd, the man whose father was dragged to shreds by Lawrence behind a truck. Watch him say it. Forgive. I swear the word has feathers. I want to learn to get its wings between my teeth before more retribution blots out the sky. When I tell you, one crow broke away from the murder that flapped the sky into inky pieces, I want you to watch it with me, close enough to notice its feathers aren't black at all, like ink, only the darkest purple spread out across sky. Watch it spread, like ink, into a diaphragm stilled by the drip of pancuronium bromide, and tell me if you can tell where the muscles lock. If it is said the injection is humane, we mean this is humanity. No crack of rope, no jerk of limb, bloated face, no clenched jaw or reek rising, twisted in smoke from a cooked torso. We mean to say there is nothing to disturb the nest between our ribs. There is nothing to make a heartbeat rumble like a murder of so many wings. Sometimes I edit porn so many times that by the time they're done, I kind of just know. This is, man matching description. Because the cloth, the silk scarf that was delicate enough to cradle the neck of a cygnet was instead used in last night's strangling, it is now possible to marvel at the finish on handcuffs. Because I can imagine handcuffs pummeled by stones until shimmering, it is now possible that this flashlight searing my eyes will be too perfect to look away. Because a flashlight has more power on a southern roadside than my name or blood combined. And because there is no power left in the very human frequency range of my voice, because my name is printed in a clear font on my license that I cannot reach for before being drawn down on. Because the baton is long against my window, the gun somehow longer against my cheek, the vehicle cold against my abdomen as my shirt rises, twisted in fingers, and my name is asked again, I want to screech swan. I am only a swan. I'm gonna do just a couple more poems. This one is called I Do Have a Seam, and it's a contrapuntal. So I'm gonna read it like three different ways. I'll read the left side, the right side, and I'll read the whole poem. I do have a seam, and you see it there for you to pull a chrome zipper, a hollow from belly to thigh, large enough for your puncture. Pull apart until muscle, sinew, and organ are awake in your room. Woman here with plump thumbs, woman I'd fail for, careful seamstress, you stitch my selvage as it frays, but do you know how to be thread spooled through? I do have a seam in the center of my chest, or strings interlocking throat to sternum, or there is only a hole barely opening, come soon, my halves billow open, and right there, pulsing within reach, woman with slender fingers, hello, you needle in my sternum. You know how ragged I've been. I've always wanted the sewing machine of your hands. I do have a seam, and you see it there for you in the center of my chest, or strings to pull a chrome zipper, interlocking throat to sternum, a hollow from belly to thigh, or there is only a hole barely large enough for your opening. Come soon. Puncture, pull apart until my halves billow open and muscle, sinew, and organ are right there pulsing awake in your room. Woman, here within reach. Woman with plump thumbs, with slender fingers. Woman I'd fail for. Hello, you careful seamstress. You needle in my sternum, stitch my selvage as it frays. You know how ragged I've been, but do you know how I've always wanted to be thread spooled through the sewing machine of your hands? The last poem is going to be another phobia. This one is called Macrophobia, the fear of waiting, aka just being impatient as hell. And I'm going to do this one from memory. Macrophobia, fear of waiting. I love too many women is maybe not the best lead-in for a conversation that will end with me telling you I love you for the first time. And this probably should have waited until at least the second date. I know this. The problem is I know it the way I knew the firecracker in my hand at 12 would only be a dull burst lost in the dirt if I let it go too soon. But still, let it go too soon. I am asking, are you like me? Are you afraid more of having hands covered in ash than you are of getting the timing wrong? I know you're sick of waiting for the dance I promised, and I know this waiting is how you will become the twirling body and clumsy hands spilling rum across the shoes of a man who cannot wait for that splash. And I know this waiting is not foreign to us, any of us. My friend, damaging blinds, looking for his cliche of a father. A child with her foot pressed against the locked door of a closet. A girl waiting online in the rain, clutching two concert tickets. It's the waiting that gets to us. Blood work. CAT scan. EPT. I'm certain a man facing a firing squad eventually longs for its impact. And this is stupid, but I couldn't wait to tell you everything about the stranger who, after pushing a peppermint over my teeth with her tongue, told me she never wanted to be outside of the listening range of my rambling, which meant a lot coming from a woman who would never hear me again. Her plane had already boarded when the voice calling her name in static over the PA reminded her that she could not afford to wait for another flight. This is stupid, but I was afraid to tell you that last night I kept fiddling with my phone through dinner because I was fascinated that every time I tried to type the word love, I missed the O, hit I instead. I live you is a mistake I make so often. I'm beginning to wonder if it's not what I've been really meaning to say. I want to say we should just go for it. Make a mistake we can both be proud of. And I want to tell you that tonight, I can hear fireworks from my balcony, signaling the end of a Tigers game, but cannot see them. The second floor isn't high enough, but the clouds above the taller buildings flicker, reflecting their lights. So I'm going to watch that instead. Make an evening of it. A dinner date with myself and a bowl of handmade guacamole from Honeybee Market. And this time, I'm going to wait to find out if one, just one, can get high enough for me to see it explode. Thank y'all for listening. Appreciate it. Okay. So it gives me great pleasure to bring this poet up. Like her, my work has been transformed by this meeting. Like, just reading her poetry alone is enough to, like, I think, transform anybody. She is the recent winner of the Crab Orchard First Book Prize. Her book will be out in February 2014. It's called Seam. It's brilliant. I've read it. It's dope. Y'all need to check it out when it drops. And just besides that, she's just a phenomenal human being. She's one of these people that I think lives inside of the writing in a way that's just remarkable. It's a way that I think inspires me to stay inside of it. Sometimes it's kind of hard. You look and you're like, why am I doing this thing? So it's important to have writers that you can look to as, like, kind of models of, like, how to take your craft so seriously and expand what you learn as a writer into being just a good person. So I'm very excited and honored to be reading with the next poet. Please put your hands together for Tarfiyah Faizula.
Hi, y'all. Elegy ending in unrelenting splendor. For Jessica and Jacob, and in memory of Troy Davis. Twilight, hushed, and I fold my bridesmaid's dress into neat silken squares, lay it in the filling suitcase. And though tomorrow I'll stand beside the bride as she acknowledges someone else's life as crucial to her own, what I want is to sit again beside her behind the old school, to pass to her the lit cigarette after another bright and thrilling drag. Even then, we could see in each other something others couldn't, and perhaps reading those dog-eared pages of Atlas Shrugged had less to do with Rand herself than the possibility that we could choose, if we wanted, to stand against the rising tide of a world we knew would not be as kind to us as we were to each other. Lynching is alive and well, my friend despairs to me on the phone, and I tuck a cashmere wrap beside the dress, and I try to say something meaningful about the fact of each dark or light body that stood against the execution of one man. But it's total bullshit, because what I'm really thinking is that somewhere, another dark-skinned boy with a thin voice is sitting alone in a closet, writing his name again and again on a wall, that somewhere there is a man who would cleave from him the light he'll step into when his mother calls for him. That man every day wishes he could fall away from himself like silk. I know, I say before hanging up. I can't believe they went through with it either. Love is dangerous, begins the piece Jessica has asked me to read off a square of cardstock. Rich as sweet cream, a man I used to love, once erased from a corner of my mouth with his tongue, but he too is gone, shot by a man, afraid of anyone unlike him. And this is how hunger spreads now in the dusk, filling me with its longing and rage. Love is dangerous. And as I zip my suitcase shut, stand it upright, I wonder if Troy Davis could sense the exact moment his heart was about to stop, if he winced when the potassium chloride began its slow trickle, where his body is being taken, and who will sit beside it and vigil. May the man truly responsible spend his life searching for anyone to love him, and may each morning he wakes be unlacerated from the blood laving his dreams. May your lives be touched by every happiness, I'll say to the newlyweds, clasping their hands in mine. Praise the love that allows us these cold sips of champagne, these bites of cake we offer each other. Praise Big Sur behind us in all its wild glory. Praise ocean scalloping white sand, light incarnadine. Praise the setting sun radiating through each wave, crashing together in endless, unrelenting splendor. Self-portrait as Slinky. It is true that I wanted to be beautiful before I wanted to be authentic. Say the word exotic. Say minority, a coiled dark curl a finger might wrap itself in. The long staircase, and I was the willed momentum of metal springs descending down and down. Say tension. The long staircase, and I was a stacked series of spheres fingertipped into motion. say taught, like a child who must please her parents but doesn't know how, like a curl pulled thin. It is true that I wanted to be a kind of reckoning, to gather into each day a pale hand, that helpless lurching forward in the dark, and then that sudden halting. So I'm gonna dedicate this poem to my friend Cynthia, who has invited both me and Amelia Phillips, who is another local Richmond poet, to be the judge for Poetry Out Loud at St. Catharines. I remember the last time I did that, I went to an Episcopalian private school growing up, which made me very confused. So Wojon was sitting next to me and he was like, "Are you having Anglican flashbacks?" And I was like, "I totally am." So I went back and I wrote this poem. It's called Poetry Recitation at St. Catherine's School for Girls, and it begins with an epigraph by Orhan Pamuk from his novel Snow. If this were the beginning of a poem, he would have called the thing he felt inside him the silence of snow. Before the hanging cross, the girls take turns standing at attention before us, with eyes closed or hands clasped, headbands bright green or bangles yellow, glints that fill the silence like falling snow. They recite poems they have carried in their mouths for days, and my desire to go back to be one among these slender, long-haired girls is a thistle, sharp and twisting at my side. The words psalm, blessing, Lord, rise in me like bees heavy with pollen, and the teenager I once was unzips herself from me, emerges, a crocus bristling through snow. She's back again in the old chapel where the priest again lifts into the air the Bible, declaims about the kingdom of God, gifts promised only to the righteous. And the girl I was, heavy and slow in her thick glasses, knew she would never enter heaven, never be any of these young girls singing, their arms pale and slim as the white birch whose branches, dappled with gold, shade the stained glass window. In Pamuk's novel, the headscarf girls in eastern Turkey hang themselves rather than go uncovered, and I still desire that certainty of conviction, even as the self beside me pulls on her hair, sucks long strands of it deep into her mouth. So I gather her in my arms, shake her, tell her to listen, that the sky will always happen, these branches. Sometimes it causes me to tremble. She sings beside those girls who will grow into or away from their own bodies. And I know that I must push the heavy amber of her back inside me. Help me, Lord. There are so many bodies inside this clumsy one. Mango, and this is a guzzle. She says, "Your English is great. How long have you been in our country?" And I say, "Suck on a mango, bitch, since that's all you think I eat anyway." Mangoes are what model minorities like me are supposed to know jack shit about. A mango doesn't make high SAT scores, kiss white boys, or go to Yale. A mango is a placeholder in a poem folded with saris. But this mango, the one I'm going to shove down her fucking throat, is a mango that remembers jungles jagged with insects. This mango was cut down by a scythe that beheaded soldiers, a mango that taunts, only shows itself a couple times a year. This mango grew fat while blood stained green ponds. Why use a mango to beat her to death? Why not a coconut? Because this mango won't be cracked open to reveal its own whiteness. This mango isn't exotic merely because of a bone-hard brown shell. This mango knows it's worth waiting for, wants to be needed for ripeness. Mango, my own sunset-skinned heart waiting to be held and peeled. Mango, my mother taught me to cut open with my teeth. This, Tarfia, is how you eat a mango. The last time I saw my mom, she was telling me about how fond she was of watching movies in Bangladesh when she was growing up. And so she told me about the Sophia Loren movie that she loved called Sunflower. And that's kind of how this poem came about. It's called Sunflower. I want to tell you about my first kiss at 15 in a parking lot in West Texas, how the asphalt glistened beneath us as I stood on my toes, cupped the back of his dark neck, with a hand marveling at its own steadiness. The same age you must have been, mother, sitting wrapped in that movie hall in Bangladesh as Sophia Loren and Sunflower leapt onto the train in Russia away from her lover, the new life he owed the other woman standing at his side. As if we too could rise again into ourselves without history, as if I could erase that memory of my own wet and ruptured mouth. Lately, so much is precious to me, the delicate clasp of a gold necklace on the back of a stranger's neck, the sight of my love running his fingers through another woman's hair, the flare of the summer's first firefly. Once, you weren't yet the wife of my father, not yet the mother of a wild daughter who still candles with the desire you tried to slap from me. Mother, what if we could husk ourselves free of our own longings? Once, you watched Sophia Loren sob past blurring fields of sunflowers grown tall from corpses of Italian soldiers forced to dig their own snowy graves. And once, you read and reread the letters a young lover wrote you. A year later, you married my father, and another year after that, I was born. If only we could take each other's stories for our own. Mother, when I call to ask about watching Sunflower in Bangladesh, what you remember isn't the grief that streaked Sophia Loren's hair gray, nor the scene in which her lover is dragged through the Russian front's last hard snow by the woman who would grow warm and wide with his child. You don't even remember the human evening you must have stepped into after the credits rolled, adjusting again with resignation the long scarf over your breasts, where the letters of a man you wouldn't marry were still hidden. Once, a voiceless boy stayed up with me all night, then told me he loved me. He wore a belt that had belonged to his father. It smelled like the shape of his hands. And once, I fell asleep, touching myself at only the thought of him. How, mother, do I unlet the shame I learned from you, dark and coarse as dusk? I'm asking you now why we can't acknowledge desire when you remember that Sophia Loren's lover kissed her hard between sun-planked boats while the ocean lapped at their bare legs, before the war that would sever and reshape their only lives. Before all those years, you and I stopped trying to apologize to each other. Mother, I wanted to remind you of the beauty of the body when it allows itself to shimmer, a glimpse of itself before it darkens again into a wide and distant sea. What I Want is Simple. It has an epigraph by Paul Elward. The earth is blue like an orange. Easy enough to begin with the fuchsia dress I wore that night, the scent of storm threading the brief wind that gusted away its hem from my thighs, or even the distinctive gleam of your bald head reflected in the mirror's surface. Craig, I want to begin instead with this orange, moldy in its yellow bowl by the window. Days it has rested there, glossy as a child after a summer spent outside. Days I have looked past it, to crumbling brick walls of other buildings, to smoke from a chimney, engraved for a moment on gray sky. It bewilders me that for days I have looked at this piece of fruit without seeing it, even as it continues to grow its own blue shroud. And now you two are gone. In that photo, I am a waste towards which black hair spills. In that photo, you smile towards someone or something I can't see. Wait, begin again. I want back that night you pulled me into your lap, insisted I stay there. I want the elegant hinge of your wrist, the way you always were both a body and a bird. How is it I am still able to feel my own collarbones, these silken junctures of bone and bone? Wait, begin again. I want back the way you were never and always listening. I don't want to tell you again about the curve of a clothesline on a rooftop in Bangladesh, how it sagged with the weight of grandmother's damp and draped saris. In that photo, I am the weight that, for a time, pinned you, held you still. In that photo, you're wearing a green sweater. There is so much to take back, give, receive. There is, somewhere, your green sweater. What I want is simple. You, alive. Like the day we bought an orange like this one, I am now lifting from its bowl to throw away. How many times I have looked squarely at the world and thought nothing of turning away. So I feel like I have to represent with the Sistinas since Jamal did his. This is called Amulet. For years, I watched you kneel down to pull roots from hard Texas earth. Onions, tomatoes split open by sun or insect or rain. Is this still, Father, the one gift we have in common? This desire for bone below flesh, the earth laid bare, the body, its memory of the long river shore it sprang from? Beneath blue sky, your body continues its bending and pulling, your blue shirt sweat-soaked, your fingers gnarled as ginger root, knuckles curling around dying vines. My memories of you always trembling there between sky-filled openings of ash trees, the silence between us still hard as white bone. how impossible this wish for you to be as easy with me as with one of your patients. A young girl, perhaps, who will have won you over with a coy smile, questions about the blue tube stethoscope you press against her heart, not bone, but veined and vibrant flesh. You will be gentle as you root around in your lab coat pocket for some sweet she'll open after you close it into her small palm. Do you remember, Father, nights some sweetness passed between us? I remember, too, each silent twilight that frayed my room's wide window, one of many surfaces in which my sister's ghost still shimmers. Open the door. Speak to me. I'm still here, standing against the blue midnight, waiting for you to say anything true. The long roots between us, still intact, like in each neat box in your garden. Bone pale, Father, color of her corpse and its narrow casket. Bone pale, the wet marrow of poplars and heavy rain, the memory of her body flung across sky, one of many uncut roots between us. You are the man who walks alone with one amulet to guide you, a small Quran, the pages thumbed blue. And I am the daughter, alone in my kitchen, palming a tomato, opening drawers to search for the sharpest blade to slice its red flesh open. You are the father bent over a prayer mat, the horizon a thin bone disappearing into the backyards of other families, happier families. Father, the wind blew hard the night I walked out of myself, a datura in bloom. Remember that I left with nothing more than the name you gave me, the one amulet guiding me through and back to you. Its tenuous roots, like the blue-blossomed hyacinth, you tend in each unrooted memory. Open your palm. Here is my name. The only one I have. Hold it steady, like each bone you never forgave yourself for breaking. So last night I was up until like 1 a.m. doing transcription for this interview with Gary Snyder. And you don't realize until you've done a lot of transcription that nobody speaks in complete sentences or complete paragraphs ever. And it is the most infuriating thing. But he said something that I thought was really cool, which was that everyone at some point has to restate their mission. And this is a poem I wrote while I was in graduate school at VCU, and I feel like one of the reasons I keep coming back to this poem is that I feel like it continually seems to be a restatement of what I try to do and what Jamal and I have talked about doing for a long time as writers. So thanks again for coming. You ask why write about it again. Because the morning's already exhausted light exposes a child's handprints smudged on cream and green walls. Because the deaf child cannot know the sounds of her own grief, because sleep comes or doesn't come. The hand pressed hard against the window doesn't want to be the hand that lifts the pen again to write the word sister, the word silence. The hand desires blossoms instead, blue hyacinths, whorls of pooled wax. Because the blade held by the hand is still a blade, even when used for crushing and not cutting. Dill, cardamom, a bulb of garlic, pink and yellow pills. Because we want to be hand and blade and window, but our stains on walls instead. Praise the lantern mottled with dusk, the heft and shimmer of grief, unnamed but questioned. Praise the red leaves and white candle, the metal canisters brimming with lentils, cumin, and fennel. Praise the ailanthus moth spinning its coarse silk because it cannot stop and because it must.